Yeah, so in the talk earlier today, as I said, I talked about the man, and now we'll move on and talk about the message of the man. And yeah, as Vididak just said, the first part of Dada Rinpoche's motto for the school, cherish the doctrine. And apparently, Dada Rinpoche was quite involved himself in translating the words of the motto from the Tibetan into English. So him being involved in that process must mean that these words have been chosen deliberately and chosen quite precisely, chosen for a reason. So I think it'd be good just to start off with by looking at these particular terms that Dada Rinpoche has chosen. So first of all, cherishing. The dictionary said protect and care lovingly. Cherishing is to protect or care lovingly, or even to keep in mind. It apparently comes from the Latin root carus, which means dear. So all of those terms are to do with the heart, aren't they? So to do with the heart, that which we care for, that which we treasure, that which we love, even that which we adore. So when we use the word cherishing, we're in that kind of territory. And I guess for myself, one way of thinking about cherishing is simply to think of something greater than myself. So I would cherish something if I regarded it as being something greater than myself. And with things that we regard as being greater than ourselves, we put them in the center of our lives, don't we? We put them in the center, and we even elevate them above us. So there's an aspect of love, of care, even of reverence and of worship. So when we use the word cherishing, it's quite a strong word, quite a powerful word, and carries a very sort of positive emotional force to it. Doctrine, I think, needs a little bit more unpacking. So doctrine, I don't know about you, but it can strike me as being somewhat negative or having kind of negative connotation. Sometimes we think of Christian doctrine or church doctrine, which seems to stray into the territory of dogma and something kind of imposed. That's not actually what the word means when we look at the definitions for them, but it can have these negative connotations. The dictionary definition doesn't really help with that. So the dictionary definition is belief or set of beliefs held by the church. Or groups. So belief or set of beliefs held by the church or groups. But again, going to the Latin root, the root for the word doctrine is doctrina, which simply means teaching. So for us, we've got a ready-made alternative in the word dharma. So the dharma as teaching. So when we cherish the doctrine, we cherish the dharma. We cherish the teaching of the Buddha. But I think we can go a bit further than that, go a bit deeper than that, because we've got to ask the question, haven't we? What is the teaching? I was saying in the talk earlier today that Dada Rinpoche seemed to go very deeply into things in that respect, and Bhante has done that. You know, what is the teaching, essentially? What is the essence of the teaching? Where does it come from? What is the Dharma? These are all questions that get thrown up when we talk about cherishing the doctrine, cherishing the Dharma. And to answer that, we've got to go all the way back to the time of the Buddha, all the way back to the Buddha's enlightenment underneath the Bodhi tree. And we know from the Aryaparayasana Sutta, the Buddha said himself, that at that time, after his great realization, the reflection emerges for him in these words, so deep, subtle, very profound is this Dharma that I have realized. Hard to see, hard to understand, and not to be understood by mere reasoning, not to be understood by mere thinking. So that is the Buddha's expression of his realization, that this Dharma that he's realized is beyond words, it's beyond ideas, it's inexpressible, ineffable. Is this reality that he has discovered. So when the communication comes later on, when he does formulate a way of speaking about the Dharma, when he does put that into words, It's coming out of something that is ultimately beyond those words. Those words are merely pointers, pointing the way. And I think you get a real sense of that if you read some of the early Buddhist texts. So if you read the Udana, you definitely get a sense of that. And Bante's commentary on the Udana is absolutely amazing. He just seems to have a grasp for what that early experience of the Buddha must have been like. He calls it Buddhism before Buddhism, or archaic Buddhism. So this is Buddhism before the Buddha's even called the Buddha. All that has happened is that he's woken up, is the Nirvana, is the enlightenment. He hasn't put any of that into words yet, and nobody has words to describe it. So what the Buddha starts to do is he takes words that people already know and he imbues them with a new meaning. So he takes the word Brahmin, which everybody knows is a holy man, is one of the priestly castes, but he imbues it with new meanings. So he says, okay, you think this is what a Brahmin is. Actually, this is the real Brahmin. And in that communication, he is trying to point to what true enlightenment is, what full and perfect enlightenment is and looks like. So that is the nature of the Buddhavacca, of the word of the Buddha. Elsewhere it gets described as the Amitavacca, the deathless speech. So the Buddha does use words, but it is the Buddhavacca, the Buddha's words. There is speech, but it's the Amitavacca, the deathless speech. So you see, we've got these two aspects to the word Dharma. We've got Dharma as teaching, in the formulations, in the lists that we're all familiar with, in the words, but we've got the Dharma as ultimate reality itself. And when the Buddha communicates, both of those things are there. Both of those things are in play. We've got the words, we've got the expression, but where is that expression coming from? Where are those words coming from? What are they imbued with? They're imbued with the Buddha's enlightened consciousness. So when we talk then about cherishing the Dharma, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about cherishing the Dharma with that kind of depth, in those two kinds of ways, if you like. The Dharma as outward form and its expression as teaching, but the Dharma's essence as ultimate ineffable reality. Okay, and one more implication, I suppose, to draw out of that is given the origins of the Dharma, of that communication, we can see it as a stream, as something living. So for us to be in receipt of the Dharma, well, it has to have come from somebody. Ultimately, it comes from the Buddha. So those first words imbued with his enlightenment, his realization, that gets transmitted. So you all know the stories, how the Buddha goes back to the five ascetics, communicates first to Kandanya. He understands it. The Buddha says he knows. Kandanya knows. And then from him, others start getting it. So we get this transmission and this living stream of communication of the Dharma. You know, we get the early Buddhist teachings, we get the Mahayana, we get the Vajrayana, and that's just been passed on and on and on through space and time. If you like, the timeless, the eternal, getting expressed and unraveling, unfolding through time and in communication. And I'm making that point because that's true for us. So none of us know the Dharma from our own kind of reasoning and our own working of it out. We've all learnt the Dharma from somebody. We've all been taught, we've all been told these different Dharmic formulations by somebody. It's come through somebody. And of course for us, like I say, we can trace that right back to the Buddha. You've all been doing the prostration practice this morning, this afternoon, so you know that we've got all these different teachers of the past on the refuge tree. There's been a transmission through them all the way down to the teachers of the present. And obviously, most importantly for us, there's Bante and his communication of the Dharma, his presentation of the Dharma. And I think it's probably fair to say that if we are to cherish the Dharma, we have to cherish that living stream of communication. We have to cherish, we have to value, we have to care for the particular form in which we've received it. So for all of you guys who've asked for ordination, you want to be part of the order founded by Bhante, founded by Sangharakshita, based upon his particular presentation of the Dharma, his translation of the Dharma, his translation of that whole living stream through the centuries in a form that we can understand it in our modern and for most of us Western culture. So if we want to cherish the Dharma, we also have to have at least respect and gratitude for the particular form in which we've received it. So that's the first thing that I wanted to say. I think just picking up on that point as well, I think Bhante wanted us to do that. So the way he's talked about the order, the way he's talked about the different emphases of the order, he obviously wanted us to be familiar with those emphases. And we can so easily take them for granted. So things like the centrality of going for refuge, the importance of spiritual friendship, exploration of the arts, you know, we just take that as being the Dharma, but it's not. It's a particular emphasis, particular presentation of the Dharma. So I think we need to appreciate what we've got, but we don't just stop there. So we have to thoroughly learn and understand Bhante's particular presentation of the Dharma, but we don't just have to stop with Bhante. What Bhante often did, and if you look back at all those lecture series, he would take a text like the Udana, for example, as I've already mentioned, and he'd expound the text, he'd draw out themes. And in doing that, what he was trying to do was not just give us practical tools to live a Buddhist life. He was also introducing us to those texts. He was guiding us into the whole sutra treasure, as it gets called in the Avatamsaka Sutra. So Bhante guided us into the realm of the different sutras, different suttas of different Buddhist schools. And I think we should follow him. I think we need to go back ourselves to the Buddha Vacha, to the Amita Vacha, to the word of the Buddha himself. Obviously with Bhante as our guide, and as our understanding stemming from his, taking us into that territory. But if we really want to cherish the doctrine, let's go into the sutra treasure for ourselves and explore that territory very deeply and learn what it has to show us, what it has to reveal to us. So that's the direction I want to go in this talk, is to look more at cherishing the doctrine from the perspective of exploring more fully the Buddhist scriptures or the Buddhist canonical literature, to use that expression. And as I say, I think Bhante would want us to do that. There is his book, The Eternal Legacy, which came out quite recently again in the Complete Works, which is an overview of the whole Buddhist canonical literature. Well worth reading if you haven't read it before. So I'd like to explore things in that kind of way. Maybe an opening question for us and something to explore a bit tomorrow is, well, do we do that already? Do we actually read the suttas, whether it's the suttas of early Buddhism, the Mahayana sutras, Vajrayana tantras, things like the life and liberation of Padmasambhava? Do we go to those texts? Do we actually read them? How do we read them? That might sound like an odd question, but how do we read them? We might just think, oh, you just take it off the shelf and you open it and you read it. But I think there's more to it than that. There's an art to reading Buddhist texts. I suppose what I've got in mind is something like in the Christian tradition, and the practice of Lectio Divina, where you read, in their case, the Bible, but you read a text, not just to digest information or to take in the words, but to pursue a particular spiritual experience. So you read the text, in their case, to arouse a desire for heaven. You look at the text, you recognize that the words are a kind of outer shell, but there's a deeper meaning that one is trying to penetrate. And I think it's this kind of reading of Buddhist texts that Bhante has encouraged, so a really deep reading in that kind of way. And perhaps we don't talk enough in those terms about the Buddhist scriptures. I found a great teaching from Bhante in a talk called The Glory of the Literary World, which was a talk he gave to launch The Eternal Legacy when it was first published. And again, it's in one of the latest Complete Works editions. And I think this is one of Bhante's kind of hidden teachings or forgotten teachings. He gives five instructions in this talk on how to effectively read Buddhist scriptures. Five instructions, which we could say are five instructions that would help us cherish the doctrine, at least in its scriptural form. So I want to go through these five now, just quickly, so we've got them on our fingertips, so to speak, as we move on into other areas. So number one, Bhante says to read Buddhist scriptures effectively, read for enjoyment. So read them for enjoyment. So you're not reading them because you have to, because somebody's told you to. You're reading them because you want to. You're drawn to read a particular text, you have an affinity with it, so you can read it for enjoyment. And to the extent that we do that, we're immersing ourselves in that process in a highly positive emotional state. So reading for enjoyment can bring about that highly positive emotional state. The second one is read the text as a whole. So don't just pick out a little bit, read the whole text. And he says that's important because then you experience its gestalt, to use a word that I'm not going to bother trying to define. It's basically a pattern. You get the overall pattern of the particular text. You could say, in my own language, you get the atmosphere of the text, you get a feel for the text. You immerse yourself in the particular world of that text. And they do have different feels, don't they? You'll have read enough Buddhist scripture to know there's a difference between the Dhammapada and the Vimalakirti Nidesha, for example. So that's the second thing. Read it as a whole so that you experience its atmosphere. Thirdly is read the text as poetry. So read the text as poetry. So this would be, wouldn't it, to look for the deeper meaning in the outer appearance of the words in front of us. That's what we do when we read poetry. We know that the poet is communicating, if you like, an image through words, painting an image or a feeling or an emotional tone or a spiritual experience through words. So when we're reading poetry, we appreciate that we're not just gathering information, that the words point beyond themselves. So it's the same when we read a Buddhist text. We can read it as poetry. Fourthly is read it for its own sake. By which I think Bhante means read it for the purpose that it was intended for. So don't read it with any kind of ulterior motive. Read it for the purpose it was written for. Or written down for, which of course is to arouse in us the desire for enlightenment. We read Buddhist texts to pursue our goal, which is enlightenment. So we're not reading texts to learn about ancient Indian agricultural practices or anything like that. We're reading the text to pursue the path to enlightenment. And then the last one is the fifth one, be selective with the texts and the translations. He doesn't put it quite like that, that's my reading of it, but be selective with the text and translations. So Bhante says some texts, they engage us much more fully than others do. So some might only engage us intellectually, whereas others seem to engage us not just intellectually, but emotionally, imaginatively. So choose those texts that are going to speak to us, speak to the whole of us, if we're listening. And also with the translations, he said some of the translations will capture the poetic spirit of the original more so than other translations. And again, we've probably discovered that for ourselves as well. So be selective with the texts and with the translations. Okay, so they're the five instructions from Bhante on how to engage effectively, develop a relationship with the Buddhist texts. In our case, I think we could rephrase that. These are five ways in which we can train ourselves, actually, to cherish the doctrine, particularly in its scriptural form. So if we approach the scriptures in this way, we'll be cultivating our capacity to really cherish the doctrine in both its outward external form as teaching, but also in its inner form as essence of reality, for want of a better phrase. So I think that's quite an important little set, and I think it can be helpful to us. And I think in emphasizing or going down this route and in this direction with the talk, it just struck me that the best thing to do next would be to actually practice that a little bit and to actually go into a particular text, to plunge into a Buddhist sutra and really explore it. And the text I'd like to look at this evening is the Amitāya Dhyāna Sutra, which is one of the Pure Land Sutras of Mahayana Buddhism. And I've got the translation here if you'd like to know, by Shraddhapa, which is published in Ratnaguna's book, Great Faith, Great Wisdom. And I've chosen this sutra to explore this evening because, firstly, I think it's an example of one of the types of text that Bhante is pointing us in the direction of in those five points, in that it really does speak to the whole of us. And I think the translation also has the poetic spirit of the original. Not that I've read the original, but it's a poetic rendering. So there's that, but also reading and reflecting on the text recently myself, it just strikes me that there are particular teachings in there, particular lessons in there that I think will help us to more fully appreciate what it means to cherish the doctrine. So that's what we're going to do for the rest of the talk. We'll plunge into the Sutra Treasure. We'll look specifically at the Amitāya Dhyāna Sutra. So to set the scene, I'll just give you a brief account of where the sutra starts and what happened. It's not a particularly long text. I recently recited this over three evenings, just 15 minutes each evening, something like that. So it's not a long text. It begins with the Buddha Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha, at Rajgriha, and he's on Vulture's Peak at Rajgriha, and he's there with an assembly of 1,250 monks and 32,000 bodhisattvas led by Manjushri, the prince of the Dharma. So instantly we recognize this as a Mahayana Sutra. The Buddha's there with this whole retinue, this whole assembly gathered around him. And at that time in Rajgriha, there was a prince called Ajatasatru. And Ajatasatru has come up with this plot to displace his father, the king, Bimbisara. And he's done that in league with Devadatta, who's the Buddha's cousin, who also wished to remove the Buddha from being the head of the Sangha and replace him. So they've come up with this devious scheme to seize power. So Ajatasattu has locked his father in a prison tower on the seventh floor, and he's left him there to die. He's not been fed or anything like that. Ajatasattu's mother, Queen Vayadehi, she's secretly visiting Bimbisara in this tower. And when she goes to visit him, beforehand she's bathed her body, and then she covers it in a mixture of honey, ghee and flour. So kind of honey paste all over her body. All of her jewellery she fills with grape juice. And she takes all of that into this prison cell in the tower where King Bimbisara is. And obviously he licks this paste off her body. He drinks the grape juice. And also because he's one of the Buddha's disciples, he's got the Dharma as well. So he's been fed. He's practicing the Dharma. He's quite happy. He's quite content to be locked up in the tower there. So all's going well, but then Ajatasattu finds out what's happening. So he finds out and he's furious with his mother. He's furious with Vayadehi. He draws his sword and he's about to kill his own mother, but his ministers step in. Apparently it's fine for him to have locked his father in the seventh floor of this prison tower and leave him there to die, but killing your mother in ancient India is an absolute no-no. So the ministers step in and they refuse to allow him to do that. So what Ajatasattu does instead, he throws his mother Vayadehi into the deepest dungeon and he leaves her there and vows never to release her. So Vayadehi, as you could probably imagine, is she's just distraught with worry, with sadness at being thrown into this deep dungeon. The text says that tears fall from her face like rain. So upset is she, so traumatized is she. And in that state of desperation, she turns towards Vulture's Peak. She turns herself into the direction of Vulture's Peak. She bows to the Buddha and she just begs him. She says, although I can't gaze upon your face, please send Ānanda and Modgalyāyana to see me in this dungeon so that I can just see them and hear the Dharma. So just pause there briefly. So the text is very vivid in its portrayal of Vayadehi. Like I said, tears falling from a face like rain. Really, she is in a desperate situation. She's lost her freedom. She's lost her liberty. But of course, she's also lost her husband. The king now is not being brought food and nourishment, so the king will die. And also, perhaps even worse than all of that, her son has turned evil and thrown her into the dungeon and killed the husband. And all she's got left in that situation is the Dharma. So that is her only hope in that terrible state of desperation. All she's got is the Dharma. So I'm almost sorry to say this, but that's our situation too, isn't it? So not literally. We're not imprisoned, obviously. We do have our liberty and our civil liberty and all of that. But existentially, this is our situation too. So we are imprisoned. We are not free to the extent that we are bound and caught up in vijnana, in divided consciousness, in seeing things, in experiencing things in terms of self and other, in terms of subject and object, to the extent that we are overcome, however slightly, by greed, hatred and delusion, we are not free. We are in a state of bondage and of imprisonment. And we don't have to look far in the Buddhist canonical literature to get that message. So think of something like the fire sermon, one of the Buddha's earliest teachings, where he just comments on the fact that the world is on fire. The world is burning with longing. The eye is burning, the ear is burning, the nose is burning, the senses are burning. You also get in the White Lotus Sutra the parable of the burning house. that although things might look all fine and pleasant, in a sense, we can just be entertaining ourselves, amusing ourselves with toys in this great house that is on fire, with its roof beams about to fall down upon us. And of course, the Buddha outside of the house, desperately trying to call us and coax us out of that situation. So I'm not saying all this to be down on life. It's not an expression of pessimism. Of course, life is good and life can be pleasant. But if we don't see that our existential situation is that urgent and that desperate, we can't cherish the doctrine. We can't cherish the doctrine because we don't see its true value. It's only if we see the desperate existential situation that we're in, the fact that we are in a world of uncertainty, complete uncertainty, where nothing can provide us with a refuge and with security. It's only when we see that that we recognize that the value, that the Dharma is what has real value. It's the Dharma that offers security. It's the Dharma that offers a refuge to us in that situation. So we're just like Vayadehi. In a sense, we have nothing except the Dharma. Okay, so if we can take that on board, we'll see its true value. We can really cherish the doctrine. But how then do we do that? You know, I'm sure I'm not under any illusion that you don't see the value of the Dharma. You know, you wouldn't have asked for ordination if you didn't already understand that the Dharma is the most valuable thing in the world. Obviously, you want to commit your lives to it. So we do know that to some extent. But how do we really take that to heart? How do we more and more deeply and fully take on board that the Dharma is our one true refuge? Well, let's go back to the sutra, because I think we find an answer there. So the Buddha intuits Vayadehi's plea. He intuits the fact that she's called out to him from that dungeon. And he does what she wishes. He sends Ananda and Modgalyayana to the dungeon. Not on foot, they fly through the air, apparently, to the dungeon. And the Buddha himself vanishes from Vulture's Peak and reappears in front of Vayadehi. At that point, what he does, he sends a golden ray of light. Again, we can tell we're in a Mahayana Sutra. A golden ray of light from the tuft of hair between his eyebrows. And that golden ray of light creates a kind of golden platform upon which Vayadehi can see all the Buddha fields in all the 10 directions of space. So all these different Buddha fields appear before her in all their majesty. And Vayadehi, in amongst all of those Buddha fields, she sees Sukhavati. She sees Sukhavati, the land of bliss, the Buddha field of Amitabha in the Western realm. And she says to the Buddha, "That's where I want to go. I want to be in Sukhavati, in the land of bliss. Can you teach me how to dwell there, how to be in the land of bliss?" So here's what the Buddha then says to her. So the Buddha says to Vayadehi, "Those who wish to be born in that Buddha field should cultivate merit in three ways. Firstly, one should respect and support one's parents, honor and serve one's teachers. Cultivate a mind filled with compassion and refrain from taking life, and practice the 10 kinds of skillful action." That's the 10 precepts that we follow in the order. "Secondly, one should hold fast to the three refuges, observe all the precepts, and conduct oneself properly. Thirdly, one should cultivate a mind set on awakening and a deep faith in conditioned co-production. One should read and recite the Mahayana Sutras and encourage others in their practice. This is what is meant by purifying the effects of one's actions. The Buddha then said to Vayadehi, "You do not know it yet, but it is by acting in these three ways that all the Buddhas of the past, the present, and the future will purify their actions." So that's the first teaching the Buddha gives to Vayadehi. And you can see he's giving her the very fundamental teachings there, isn't he? So the refuges and precepts, metta, in a sense, and cultivating right view as well through the Mahayana scriptures. So we could say that all of those teachings that the Buddha is giving Vayadehi there, they're all in the sphere of ethics, aren't they? They're all instructing her in how to purify her mind through taking the refuges and precepts and practicing them. And by doing that, she'll see the value of the Dharma, in this case, by seeing the land of bliss, the land of Sukhavati. So again, drawing the lesson out for us, if we do want to cherish the doctrine, if we want to see its value, obviously we need to be practicing it. We need to be practicing from the ground up, so to speak. We need to be practicing those fundamentals. So purifying our mind through taking the refuges and precepts, practicing metta, cultivating right view. It is fundamental, isn't it? We probably say it on every retreat, but going for refuge is the central thing. That's what we're placing at the center of our lives and elevating. And the practice of the precepts, as Bhante says in the Ten Pillars, are the lifeblood of our going for refuge. If that lifeblood ceases to circulate, then the organism itself, the going for refuge, ceases to be. So in terms of seeing the value of the Dharma, given our existential situation, fundamental that we really practice the basics, so-called practicing ethics. The Buddha then goes on to give a further teaching, and this is to do with meditation. He's basically giving a very elaborate threefold path to Vayadehi. So he starts with ethics, and then he moves on to meditation. And the meditation that he teaches us, teaches her and us, is the visualization of Sukhavati and the visualization of the Buddha Amitabha flanked by two bodhisattvas. And you've really got to read it to believe it, I think. It's such an elaborate description of Sukhavati. So I'll just give you I'll just give you the highlights. So the meditation starts by visualizing the sun. So the setting sun, dazzling in its beauty, suspended in the air like a drum, I think the text says. And that the setting sun is above a great body, a vast body of water. The water then freezes over and becomes solid, and then it turns into lapis lazuli. You then see that the lapis lazuli is supported by multiple pillars, and these pillars are all made of gold, studded with diamonds, made of the seven precious substances. They're giving off thousands of rays of light in 84,000 different colors. That light is reflected like 100,000 million suns, and it's so bright that we can't possibly even see it. And that's just the beginning of the meditation. And then it goes on. So this blinding light creates a platform of light with all these billions of palaces that are also giving off light. It's all light and color. You get trees that are 8,000 yojanas high, which is just massive. I won't go into the specifics of the measurement. And there are banners everywhere blowing in different kinds of breezes. There are musical instruments that are playing heavenly sounds. And it's in that context that then one moves on to visualize the Buddha Amitayus. So Amitayus is another name for the Buddha Amitabha. And he appears with Avalokiteshvara on one side and another Bodhisattva Mahasthamaprapta on the other side. I'm just going to read you the description of Avalokiteshvara, because it's so beautiful that it has to be read. So the face of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara is the colour of gold from the Jambu River. The tuft of hair between his eyebrows is the colour of the seven precious substances, and it emits 84,000 rays of light. Each of these rays of light contains innumerable, uncountable, hundreds of thousands of emanation Buddhas, and each of these emanation Buddhas is attended by uncountable emanation Bodhisattvas. They all manifest naturally and spontaneously, filling all of the worlds in the 10 directions of space. His arms are the colour of red lotuses, and emit 8 billion rays of beautiful, exquisite light in the form of jewelled necklaces. All of the adornments of Sakavati are reflected in those jewelled necklaces. The palms of his hands are the colours of 50 billion different lotus flowers. On each of his 10 fingertips, 84,000 different patterns can be traced, and each of these patterns is in 84,000 colours. Each of these colours emits 84,000 rays of light. Each ray of soft, gentle light illuminates everything. With his precious hands, he guides living beings. So really a wonderful description of Avalokiteshvara there. And as I say, this is a meditation practice. So the sutra is giving a meditation practice. It's something to actually be done and visualized. So the Buddha's instructing Vayadehi to meditate in this way, to really absorb her mind on these images, on these beings, on these colors, on these different rays of light. And I think this is revealing to us that to cherish the doctrine, it's not enough just to appreciate its value. It's also necessary that we appreciate its beauty. So to cherish the doctrine, to cherish the Dharma, we need to appreciate the beauty of the Dharma. And it's a dazzling beauty of the kind that we're getting a description of, a taste of in this particular text. If only we could see it, we would see that it is a dazzling beauty like that. And of course, the text is telling us that we can see it, that what we need to do in order to see it is to make that shift from the karma loka, if you like, the realm of sense desire, to the rupa loka, to the realm of archetypal form. We don't just purify our mind through our ethical practice, also through our meditation practice. We're cultivating consciously, deliberately, higher states of consciousness. We're refining our minds so that we can see more and more beautifully. Cultivating higher states of consciousness, more refined states of mind, because we won't see the beauty of the Dharma with a coarse mind, not in a sustained way. We won't see that beauty. So we can refine through meditation, not just through meditation, so of course, we can appreciate beauty in the arts, in nature, through good communication with spiritual friends. Our mind also has that greater capacity for appreciation of beauty. So bearing all that in mind. The Buddha then goes on, and this is kind of coming to a conclusion now. The Buddha moves on to give Vayadehi further teaching. So he's given her ethics, he's given her the meditation, but he also is giving her a wisdom teaching in this text as well. As I said, it's an elaborate threefold path. It's quite subtle every now and again, just dropped in. We get all the elaborate descriptions, all the light, all the colour, all the palaces, all the banners. And then occasionally you just get the line, and the sound of the wind is the sound of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self. Or words to that effect. I don't have the actual quote. Or the musical instruments play the sound of impermanence. And it's as if we're getting reminders here that we shouldn't take it literally. Yes, we're elaborately visualizing the Buddha Amitāya in Sakavati, But the text is not saying that Amitabha is God, or that this is a real heaven. So we're constantly being reminded of the true nature of existence. That however beautiful what we might imagine might be, it's not permanent, etc. But I think there's also a more striking, in some ways, a more striking wisdom teaching in the text than this. So often we hear descriptions of insight, descriptions of wisdom put in very kind of cognitive language or cognitive terms. So descriptions of insight as something seen and known. This text doesn't do that. And I think there's an important lesson there for us, particularly with regard to cherishing the doctrine. So instead, what we get is this, which I'll read from the text. The Buddha then said to Ananda and Vayadehi, "When you have obtained a vision of these things, you should then focus your mind on the Buddha. Why should you do this? The body of all the Buddhas, all the Tathagatas, is the realm of reality, and they enter into the focused minds of all living beings. Therefore, when you focus your mind on the Buddha, your mind takes on the 32 major physical characteristics and the 84 minor physical characteristics of the Buddha. When your mind creates the Buddha, your mind becomes the Buddha. The ocean of all the perfectly awakened Buddhas arises from the focused mind. Therefore, you should concentrate your attention with an integrated mind and visualize the Buddha, the Tathagata, the Arhat, the perfectly awakened Buddha, with great care." So that's quite an extraordinary passage. When your mind creates the Buddha, your mind becomes the Buddha. So we're creating the Buddha in our minds. We're dwelling on his qualities. And to the extent we're dwelling on the qualities of the Buddha, we're dwelling on the realm of reality, is what the text is telling us. We become the Buddha. So we pass beyond Vijnana, as I said before. We pass beyond that way of seeing in terms of subject and object. If you like, we merge our mind with the Buddha's mind, with the enlightened mind, ideally. And I think we can read that, we can hear that in this particular sutra, but we can expand that out to the whole of the sutra tradition. Expand that out to the whole of the Dharma in its expressed in its scriptural form. So the suggestion that I read into this is that when we read a text, when we recite a text, when we hear a sutra, it is something that we are actively involved in. It's something that we're actually doing. We're creating a realm of reality when we engage with a text. At least that's the idea. We're trying to conjure up a realm of reality. So the sutra is not the book. In a sense, this is not the sutra. I'm reading from it, but this in itself is not the sutra. So this is the manual. This is the manual with which we create, if you like, the real sutra. We create the real sutra by reading these words and taking the outer shell of the words, but we're actually creating it in our minds, in this case, Sukhavati. And we can kind of feel it now, can't we? We've been talking about this text. I've been reading sections of the text. So we're evoking it. We're creating Sukhavati as we're involved in this communication. It's at least there to some extent. To some extent, we're dwelling. I haven't told you what happens at the end yet, so we're still sort of in the story. We're dwelling there at least to some extent. And I think if we can imaginatively identify with these Dharma realms and these environments by engaging with the sutras, then we are able to inhabit them. We're opening the way for ourselves to be able to inhabit them. and they'll inhabit us. That's how the text puts it, isn't it? So the body of all the Buddhas, of all the Tathagatas, is the realm of reality, and they enter into the focused minds of all living beings. So to the extent we can conjure up the Buddha in this way, conjure up these Dharma environments with a focused mind, they can enter us, they can come into us. So again, it seems to be suggesting a breakdown of subject and object, of ourselves as unenlightened and these Dharma environments as embodiments of reality. So let's try and do that in the future as we go forward, as we cherish the doctrine. Let's try to allow ourselves to be taken over by the Dharma as we encounter it in the form of the sutras, as we create it in the form of the sutras. Let's let the Dharma enter into us and inhabit us so that we become embodiments of the Dharma. And I think ultimately this is what cherishing the doctrine, cherishing the Dharma is really about. It means becoming the Dharma. It means embodying the Dharma, embodying the ineffable reality, and embodying the Dharma as communicated in its various forms. So this is what happens, I think, in Vyadehi's case. She reaches that kind of level of understanding, of engagement, of cherishing. So I'll just read a final passage from the sutra and then I'll conclude. So while the Buddha was speaking these words, Vyadehi and her 500 ladies-in-waiting, they haven't been mentioned before, by the way, suddenly she's in the dungeon with 500 ladies-in-waiting. Vyadehi and her 500 ladies-in-waiting listened to what he was saying. They were immediately able to see Sukhavati with all of its many different features, and they attained a vision of the body of the Buddha and the two bodhisattvas. Vyadehi exclaimed, "I have never experienced anything like this before." Her mind became clear, and she attained great realization and patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are unarisen. Her 500 ladies-in-waiting developed minds set on unsurpassed perfect awakening, and a heartfelt desire to be born in that Buddha field arose in them. The Blessed One gave each of them a prediction that they would undoubtedly be born there, and that when they were, they would attain the samadhi of being in the presence of all the Buddhas. Innumerable gods also developed minds set on unsurpassed awakening. Ananda then rose from his seat, approached the Buddha and said, "Blessed One, what is the name of this sutra, and how should we bear in mind the essence of the Dharma it contains?" The Buddha replied to Ananda, "The name of this sutra is the visualization of Sukhavati, the Buddha Amitayus, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, and the Bodhisattva Mahasthamaprapta. It is also called purifying and freeing oneself from the effect of one's previous actions and being born in the presence of all the Buddhas. This is how you should bear it in mind, forgetting nothing. Those who practice this samadhi will attain a vision of the Buddha Amitayus and the two great beings in their present body. If a child of good family simply hears the name of the Buddha or the names of these two bodhisattvas, they will free themselves of the effects of previous unskillful actions that would have kept them in samsara for countless eons. How much more effective will it be then if they recollect them? You should understand that those who recollect the Buddha are like the white lotus flowers of humanity. The Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara and the Bodhisattva Mahasthamaprapta are their closest friends. They will sit on the seat of awakening and be born into the family of all the Buddhas." The Buddha continued, "Remember what I have said. Remember the name of the Buddha Amitayus." While the Buddha was speaking these words, the Venerable Modgalayana, the Venerable Ananda, and Vyadehi listened to what he was saying, and great joy arose in them. So that is the Amitāya Dhyāna Sutra, a quick plunge into its depths and out again. And I'll just conclude now. I'll just summarise some of the points. So I hope that the talk has demonstrated that cherishing the doctrine is a very deep principle. So cherishing the doctrine is to cherish the Dharma, to cherish the expression of the Dharma in its various forms, and particularly in its scriptural form, as I've described here. But it's also cherishing reality itself, cherishing the Dharma as reality itself. In terms of exploring that more fully by engaging with the scriptures and the sutras, we've had those five instructions from Bhante to play with and to try. And I've drawn out some lessons there from the Amitāya Dhyāna Sutra, specific lessons, I think, on how we really, really cherish the Dharma. And firstly, I said that we need to appreciate its value. So really waking up to our existential situation, doing the fundamentals, purifying our actions in body, speech, and mind. If we do that, to the extent we do that, we'll appreciate the value of the Dharma. We'll be able to cherish the Dharma, cherish the doctrine more fully. But also, I said, we need to appreciate its beauty as well, the dazzling beauty of the Dharma. And again, we'll cherish the Dharma to the extent that we find it beautiful, that we recognize and appreciate its beauty. And we do that through, as I said, refining our consciousness through meditation, through any other means. Refining our consciousness, accessing higher and higher states of consciousness. And then thirdly and lastly there, I talked about really cherishing the doctrine. To really do that, we need to imaginatively identify with the doctrine, with the Dharma, with the Buddha as the embodiment of the Dharma, as a realm of reality. And if we can do that, then to that extent, we become embodiments of the Dharma. We carry the Dharma into the world. We carry the Dharma into all of our activities. We carry the Dharma into all of our interactions. We emit the Dharma for the benefit of all beings. We become bodhisattvas. We become living bodhisattvas, as in the manner that Bhante described Dado Rinpoche, or as the text has it at the end there, we become one of the white lotus flowers of humanity. So I'll finish there.